Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Honorable Court, opposing counsel. Brian Davis appearing on behalf of the appellant Herschel Huff. Your Honors, as you've already stated to the crowd, you're well aware of the case. You've reviewed the record, and despite that extensive record and the extensive trial in this case and the 5 years it's taken for us to get here, I think this boils down to a fairly simple argument. You've seen the two assignment of errors. I think they're somewhat intertwined. The first assignment of error addressed the judicial error by the district court in denying what obviously we feel the defendant of a substantial right during that trial. That judicial error addresses the specific portion of voir dire when the jurors were being examined by both counsel. There was a specific portion that went into the judge's chambers, and that proceeded with both counsel, but without the defendant being present. And that's a substantial right, obviously, we're talking about here today.
Mr. Davis, would you mind taking just a moment and explaining what voir dire is for the benefit of the audience?
Sure. Voir dire is where you bring in prospective jurors, a whole jury pool, where both sides, including the court, get to examine the jurors to see who they want to serve on that jury. The state has a certain type of juror they may want to preside, whether it's men or women or age or background, criminal history, things like that. Defense has another type they may want. The court asks questions about whether the jurors know law enforcement or the prosecuting attorneys or anyone like that. And that process you go through, and then each side gets to strike a number of potential jurors, and that's how you whittle it down and end up with the 6 or 12 jurors left to decide the defendant's fate, whether it be a misdemeanor or felony, depending on the type of case.
And would you agree that the purpose of that examination of the jurors is to arrive at a fair and impartial jury to hear the case?
I would agree.
And so the right that we're talking about today of your client is to be present during that process of jury selection.
Correct.
And that derives from the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution?
That's right. And I think in Nebraska statute, I think it's 29-2001, that makes it very clear in any felony case, when you're going to try that case, the defendant has the right to be present at every critical stage. Now, there's been some debate in case law as to what is a critical stage. Some pretrial motions or post-trial motions, a defendant may not have to be present. If the case is given to the jury and they're deliberating to see what their verdict will be, they may ask a question to the judge, something they're confused about. Sometimes the counsel will go into the judge's chambers, address it, and how the court's going to respond to the jury, and the defendant may not need to be present for that.
So in this case, there was examination of a few number of jurors that happened in the judge's chambers, in the judge's office privately.
That's right.
And Mr. Huff was not present during that, although his attorneys were.
That's correct.
So can you then give us your best argument as to why that violated his constitutional and statutory rights?
The best argument that I think is an obvious one for anyone who practices criminal law is that he's present in the courtroom, and by he, I mean Mr. Huff, my client, and they're examining the jurors out in front of, or in the courtroom. So when they went to go into chambers, if you look at the record, who brought that up? It was the prosecuting attorney. They wanted to interview these eight jurors total, about their experience. They raised their hand when they were asked about, have you been convicted or charged with a DUI? The DUI in this case was a central element to manslaughter, motor vehicle homicide, a refusal of a chemical test. It was central to almost, I think, all of the charges in the case. And when they raised their hand, the state's attorney said, we'd like to interview these specific jurors in private outside of the other prospective jurors. And you ask, why would the state do that? It's because it was so key to the case, because they're asking, as you see by the record, these potential jurors about your experience with your DUI, the arresting officer, how you feel towards law enforcement, how are you treated? Has that affected your ability to impartially decide this case? Do you hold it against Mr. Huff or the other way around? And that's so central and such a critical stage because it was so key to the case. And voir dire is a process where the courts have held, the United States Supreme Court has held, the defendant has a right to participate in that process because they can not only give suggestions to their attorney, they can supersede them. They can fire them and represent themselves.
So we're talking about 34 minutes, right, where potential jurors were meeting with the judge. Attorneys were present during that process. Did Mr. Huff at any time make a request to be present in chambers for that process?
No, and I think I mentioned the federal rule in some of the federal cases where it talks about the defendant didn't make a request to be there, and because they didn't make a request, they somehow waived it. I think in Nebraska, that is not the law. It says they have the right to be there unless there's a knowing and intelligent waiver of that right, and it says that it should be on the record. At no point did Mr. Huff, was he advised by the trial court to say, you have the right to be present, do you understand that right, having understood that right, do you waive it? Him saying yes, then we're in a different situation. That did not happen here.
Is it the responsibility of his trial counsel to raise the issue with the judge as to the lack of presence of the client?
Yes, and I think that takes us to the deficient performance of the ineffective assistance claim that I've raised, in that any criminal law, the standard is any criminal lawyer with ordinary skill and training would do this. And no lawyer with that ordinary skill and training would purposely, and if you saw the deposition, the criminal lawyer purposely noticed that the defendant was not present in chambers and decided to leave it alone and testified at his deposition that he thought in case the case went bad, it would be an issue for appeal. The problem is then he decided not to appeal it, and I think it may have been an appealable issue, but he knew his client's right and purposely had him not there, and that's what we can't have happen. I think that's a slippery slope.
How specifically in this case did that harm your client?
That's the question, right? And these come down to whether or not this error is harmless error. I think the rebuttable presumption, it's presumptively prejudicial, meaning a presumption's been created that my client was prejudiced because it's a substantial right that was taken away from him. I think the state has the burden of overcoming that by proving, not just showing evidence that it was harmless error, but beyond a reasonable doubt that it was harmless error, and I don't think that evidence exists. And I think it's very tough for Mr. Huff to argue and present evidence as to how he was prejudiced because he lost an opportunity. Judge Doyle, as you saw in the district court order, cited a United States Supreme Court case, I believe it was Russian v. Spain, if I'm saying that right, 464 U.S. 114, talking about that harmless test. And the second one they talked about when looking at that harmless test is the loss of opportunity to mitigate, adjust, etc. after observing jurors. Mr. Huff lost that opportunity to observe. As we all know, as lawyers in the room, voir dire is important not just because of the questions asked and the answers provided, but how they're provided. Body language. Their eyes, their emotions, a situation where, say, Mr. Huff's present with his lawyer and someone's talking about their DUI experience and just bashing law enforcement and saying how horrible it was and he thinks they're crooked and defense is thinking, this is going to be a good juror. We want him on our jury. But maybe Mr. Huff notices and says, something's not right. I don't know, look in his face. I think he's faking. I think he wants to get on the jury to bury me. That's the contribution a defendant gets in that very key process. And not just voir dire, remember, this was the central portion, 34 minutes, but I would say the 34 most important minutes of the trial where they were being asked about, and these are the people that are going to decide Mr. Huff's fate and why he has that right to participate. So I think it's the state's burden to show why that wasn't harmless. And when Mr. Huff lost that opportunity, I think it became impossible for the state to rebut that presumption, why we're asking you to vacate this conviction and award Mr. Huff a new trial.
Mr. Davis, my understanding of the record, though, was that Mr. Huff did not give any input to the decisions the lawyers made at the time they exercised their peremptory strikes or their strikes for cause, for that matter. So how does that impact the argument?
That's correct, Mr. Arterburn, but the problem I have with that argument is, say, I'm handling a trial as a defense lawyer, and you have co-counsel. And for a day and a half of trial, co-counsel hasn't participated one bit. I'm on a roll, he's not helping at all, and then, boom, a question's asked, an answer's given, an exhibit pops up, he all of a sudden remembers research, whatever, and he's in the game. So just because he didn't participate that entire time is not an argument that had he had the opportunity to observe these eight potential jurors, two of which served on the jury that decided his fate, including an alternate on top of that, He didn't get that opportunity, so we don't know. You're right, it's speculation, but that's what the state has to do, is speculate, because that opportunity was lost, and that's what we can't have happen. And if it pleases the court, I'd like to remain whatever 25 seconds I have to rebuttal.
You may. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. I intend to spend the majority of my argument today on the second assignment of error regarding the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, but I would like to briefly address the first assignment of error that the district court violated Huff's constitutional rights by allowing the voir dire to take place in his chambers without Huff being present. This claim is not properly before this court because it was dismissed by the district court and as procedurally barred in the 2014 final order, and Huff did not challenge that dismissal on his appeal from that order. He focused solely on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Thus, his time to challenge that claim was in the prior appeal, and because he did not do so, he has waived the underlying constitutional claim.
So I'll just start right off the bat and ask you, is it presumptively prejudicial in this case that Mr. Huff was not in the judge's chambers during the examination of the seven or eight prospective jurors?
I do not believe it is presumptively prejudicial for a number of reasons. First of all, we're no longer on direct review. We are now on post-conviction, which puts us under the ineffective assistance of counsel umbrella as his original claim is procedurally barred. Since briefing concluded in this case, the United States Supreme Court issued an opinion in Weaver versus Massachusetts, which I believe is relevant to this court's analysis in this case. In Weaver, the issue was the violation of a right to a public trial. The voir dire was closed off from the public, and that violation would have been not just a presumption of prejudice, but it would have been structural error if it had been preserved at trial and raised on direct appeal. The issue, however, was presented to the United States Supreme Court, much like in this case, as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in a later proceeding. And even though, despite the fact that it would have been structural error on direct appeal, the United States Supreme Court did not presume prejudice under the Strickland analysis. Instead, the court held that when a structural error is neither preserved nor raised on direct review, but is raised later via an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the defendant must demonstrate prejudice to secure a new trial. And the court went on to hold that Weaver was not entitled to a new trial because he was not able to show a reasonable probability that he would have been acquitted, but for his counsel's failure to object to the supposed voir dire.
Ms. Tangeman, do you have the citation for the Weaver case?
I do have it with me.
I'm sorry.
Sorry about that.
Fix that. Don't worry about that.
It is 137 Supreme Court 1899, and that was issued on June 22nd of this year.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about the mess I just made. My point with Weaver is that case, you have a structural error on direct appeal. Here we have at most a presumption of prejudice, though I don't think the case law supports a presumption of prejudice if it had been preserved and raised on direct appeal. I think the vast majority of the case law that was cited not only in my brief but in the district court's order shows that it's a harmless error analysis if counsel had objected and raised it on direct appeal. So I think given Weaver and that we're not even under structural error, it would be inappropriate to presume prejudice in this case. And thus, in order for Huff to obtain a new trial, he would have to demonstrate a reasonable probability that he would have been acquitted but for counsel failing to object.
How does one do that if he's not allowed in chambers? How is he ever able to show potential bias or impartiality on the part of a juror that actually served? Or I guess the alternative is, one of his arguments is, one of the jurors that was not selected for the jury might have been favorable
right
to his cause.
Well, I think it honestly depends on a case-by-case basis and an analysis of what actually happened during the voir dire, what happened with the attorneys, what the issue was. What happened in the individual voir dire in this case is they were going into personal details of these seven people, of what their DUI convictions were, and it was to kind of save some face. They didn't want to embarrass them in front of the other jurors. They wanted them to be able to speak open and honestly. So I don't think that there was anything about just the nature of the voir dire itself that would prejudice Huff and his counsel was there. I think we have a completely different issue if any type of situation occurred in chambers where defense counsel wasn't present. Then we probably are looking at more of a presumption of prejudice situation.
Did the attorneys, his trial attorneys in this case, I assume, gave deposition testimony for the evidentiary hearing?
Yes.
Was there anything in there that, in their testimony, that would show any of the jurors that were selected through this process were biased or impartial?
No.
Or not impartial?
No. No, there was nothing of that nature. And actually, the individual voir dire benefited Huff because one of those seven jurors, upon further reflection, informed the court that I think he's guilty, and we were struck from talking at that point. The only two potential jurors that were subjected to individual questioning that Huff complained about to the district court in this case was juror number 102 and juror number 91. Neither one of those jurors participated in the deliberations of Huff's case. Juror number 2 was stricken from the jury during the exercise of peremptory strikes, and juror number 91 was an alternate juror, and the record does reflect that the juror was dismissed prior to deliberation. Given the fact that those two jurors did not participate, Huff cannot demonstrate that he would have been acquitted but for his presence. Finally, regarding Huff's argument that he would have been able to observe the jurors and see the jurors and get a reaction to their demeanor, it is clear from that deposition testimony that he did not play an active role in selecting the jury. This was a task that was left to the discretion of his trial counsel, and I think that makes sense. Voir dire is something that attorneys are trained in. It is something that the attorney is ultimately going to be the person making the decision who is the right juror for this case, who do we not want on this case. And so therefore, I think that also goes to the fact that Huff cannot show prejudice, given that he was not actively involved in choosing the jury. Unless this court has any additional questions, we have to confirm the judgment of the district court.
We have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Davis has a few seconds remaining.
Thank you. In response with what brief time I have left, I think we're all in agreement we're doing the harmless error analysis, and that's when I talked about the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about that and that lost opportunity, and that's why it's a critical stage. And if this is harmless error, the slippery slope is being created that, okay, opening arguments, closing arguments, okay, they weren't present for the examination of one witness, when does it stop? And they can never make an argument as to how they're prejudiced if they're not present. That's what this is saying.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both, counsel. You are excused, and your case